Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Daniel Foster of National Review, and for Jim Garrity today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis as usual. And, Dan, one of the things that the supporters of this Gang of Eight bill, particularly the Republicans, say is this is way different than what happened in 1986 with the amnesty bill. This is not amnesty. That was just basically, as Karl Rove said in the Wall Street Journal and some others have said, hey, if you've been here for a few years, you're automatically citizens. And this time we've got really rigorous hurdles that you've got to go through. Well, Ed Meese was Attorney General of the United States in 1986. He's now at the Heritage Foundation, and he is basically shredding that argument. He says that advancement to citizenship at that time was not automatic. Immigrants had to satisfy various requirements along the way. They had to pay application fees, learn to speak English, understand American civics, pass a medical exam, and register for military selective service. Those with convictions for a felony or three misdemeanors were ineligible. Sound familiar? It's pretty much the same penalties and hurdles set forth by the Gang of Eight. Today they call it a roadmap to citizenship. President Reagan called it amnesty. The 86 reform bill also had supposedly rigorous border security and immigration law enforcement provisions. So how did that pan out? On the day Reagan signed comprehensive reform into law, only one thing changed. Millions of unlawful immigrants gained legal status. The promised crackdowns on security enforcement never happened. Only amnesty prevailed. So, Dan, Ed Meese, a very solid observer of this. He was there when it happened. He's one of the great lions of the Reagan administration who's still out there in the public square. And his point is exactly right. We've done this before, and we know exactly how it turns out.
Yeah, it was a very solid, very pithy letter. And, you know, I wish that supporters of the bill would just say what their case is, because they do have a case. Their case is basically that not doing anything is the equivalent of amnesty because we're not deporting these 11 million people. The Obama administration is not going to deport them. So you might as well give them status, get a little bit better tracking on them. And that, you know, maybe this will do something for the Republican Party with the Hispanic vote. I mean, I have my doubts about that. I think a lot of people do.
Yeah.
But that's basically their case. And you tweak some things. You tweak like the high skilled immigration spots and you tweak the legal immigration system in perhaps some beneficial ways. But that's really the Gang of Eight. That's the Republican anyway case for the immigration bill. But no one will say that and admit that that's really all there is to it. And that it's a pretty flimsy case. I mean, you can hope that everything works out, but that's really the case. And on the other hand, we have the example of history to follow. And that's exactly what Meese said, that we did this in 1986, and we never got the border protection. We never got the wall wasn't built then. It's probably not going to be built now. And as he said, the only thing that really stuck, it's just like when you make a deal with Democrats on tax hikes for spending cuts. The only thing that sticks is the tax hikes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So good message there. Hopefully some more Republicans in the Senate and ultimately the House most likely will make that argument. And some of them already have. There have been some pretty eloquent and passionate arguments as to why the current version of this bill is really unacceptable in terms of America's national security and a whole lot of other things. So anyway, that's the good martini. The bad martini is the latest on the civil war in Syria. And that, of course, the Obama administration announcing on Thursday that it is now planning to arm the rebels in Syria. They have, in fact, determined officially that weapons of mass destruction were used. I believe nerve gas is what they said was used on the rebels. And so there will be arms headed to the rebels directly. There are reports of potential no-fly zones going on here. John McCain's probably doing his happy dance today because he's been calling for this for a long time. Dan, this is one of the very few areas where Jim and I disagree. He believes that this might be necessary to stop a human rights atrocity. I see it differently. I see it as basically the Iran side being the Assad side who hate us and want to kill us. And then you have the rebels who are basically, in large percentages, Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda who hate us and want to kill us. So while it's horrible what's going on there, better they kill each other than us.
I'm basically on the Greg side of this argument. In the past, you know, in Libya, I advocated a no-fly zone in print early on because of concerns about just the massive killing of civilians. I didn't like it when we intervened. I felt we had the rebellion on our back at that point. Of course, Libya turned out to be relatively pain-free for the United States, but I didn't like the late date at which we intervened when it became clear that the purpose of our intervention wasn't to stop human rights abuses. It was to tip a war that the rebels in Libya were losing pretty handily in favor of those rebels. And so we owned the kind of outcome there. And so I was one of the few people that wanted a no-fly zone there early and then became more skeptical about it late. Now, as I said, it turned out to be relatively painless for the United States, although we don't know what's going to happen in Libya in the long term. And Syria presents very similar kinds of problems. On top of all that, and I wrote about this a month ago, the CIA, the intelligence community, at least based on what's been leaked to the press, doesn't know who the rebels are, really. Doesn't know who the more trustworthy elements are. We do know that there's a small number of kind of secular elite leaders that are mostly Syrian expats. That's the way this stuff works. That's the way it worked in Iraq. That's the way it worked in Libya. And that's the way it's working in Syria, is that these Western-educated, wealthy, secular rebels, they were all either kicked out of the country or fled 20 years ago, and they're sitting around a table in Turkey somewhere pretending that they have control over the rebellion on the ground, outside Damascus. And on the other hand, the people who were actually armed and doing the fighting are, as you pointed out, essentially Islamists and warlords. And these guys look a lot like the little gangs of Taliban that were hanging around Afghanistan in the late 90s. They're basically warlords with sort of tribal affiliations. The most powerful and the most brutal are the ones that end up on top. And so you have this disconnect between the people who are fighting the war and the people who, you know, we purport to be wanting to deal with, these secular elites. And there's really just no, I think, good option for the United States. And we're going to own whatever happens there the way we have in all the other Arab Spring countries, because we're meddling. You know, I'm rambling on here. That's not to dismiss the fact that there are true human rights violations going on there and a massive atrocity. The question is, can the United States intervene in a way that clearly demarcates the good guys from the bad guys? And I don't think we can get even close to that.
I don't either. The furthest I would go, and I'm not even sure I'm this far yet, is the position from Ambassador Bolton, where he says we might need to make sure that weapons of mass destruction that are there, whether they've been used or not, don't get into the wrong hands, and maybe a couple of special forces units surreptitiously dropped in. But at the very most, that's where I'd go, because after that, I'm not really sure what the national security interest is for us there. On to martini number three now, and on to the social issues. And earlier this week, the House Judiciary Committee passed a bill that could probably pass the House, but certainly not going to get much attention in the Senate or the White House. And that's a bill that would ban abortions after 20 weeks. It's obviously inspired by the Kermit Gosnell story and other horrors from late-term abortions. And it passed the committee. And so Nancy Pelosi was asked about it on Thursday. And the way the question was couched was, what's the difference, morally speaking, between a baby who is aborted at 20-some weeks and one who is delivered and then killed on the table like Gosnell did at the same age? And she never really answered the question, other than to say that what Gosnell did was horrible, but abortion is fine. And then in her frustration with the reporter, she did this.
And what I'm saying to you is what happened in Philadelphia was reprehensible. And I do not think you use that. I'm not going to have this conversation with you because you obviously have an agenda. You're not interested in having an answer. But I have responded to you to the extent that I'm going to respond to you, because I want to tell you something. As a mother of five children, my oldest child is 6 years old the day I brought my fifth child home from the hospital. As a practicing and respectful Catholic, this is sacred ground to me when we talk about this.
Dan, I'm a Christian. I am not a Catholic. I have read the Bible. I'm pretty familiar with the Catholic position on abortion, though, so I'm not sure how late-term abortion is sacred to from a Catholic perspective. But if you can enlighten me on that, I'd love to hear it.
I wish I could. I'm a little rusty on my catechism and my doctrine, but it was an ultimately terrible word choice. I mean, to say the absolute least, it's late-term abortion, if anything, is, of course, profane, not sacred. And there's a couple things going on here. One, I'm very deferential to people's avowal of their faith. If you say I'm a practicing so-and-so, I say, okay, that's between you and Providence. But at some point, you just have to be able to say, no, you're not. I don't know if Nancy Pelosi falls inside or out that. There are plenty of American Catholics who favor abortion, unfortunately. So that's one thing. The other thing is about Pelosi. The more and more we see of her, and I've had occasion to compare some things she said about the health care bill back when it was being passed to things she said recently. And she just, she lied. She lied then, she lies now. maybe it's just the polite conservative media like National Review, but I think we're too nice to her sometimes. The fact is she's inarticulate at best. I mean, she's one of the least well-spoken major political figures in the U.S. and dumb at worst. She certainly said some really dumb things, and she's a liar. I don't know why we don't say more, you know, more frequently. I mean, she's sort of one of the worst that they have, and she's the Democratic leader in the United States House. She's, you know, I really just don't think, I don't know if you can tell, I don't think much of Nancy Pelosi.
I couldn't tell. I'm glad you clarified that at the end, Dan. Very well, very, very well done. She's definitely had her whoppers in the day, and you're right, they range from the unintelligible to the downright and demonstrably false. Even at the moment, you don't even have to look it up just to know that it's false. And this time, as you mentioned, there are certainly Catholics nationwide who are pro-choice, but I'm pretty sure most of them don't use doctrine as the reason for why they're pro-choice. So another bizarre moment, and that's how we end the week. Dan, thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join Jim Garrity and me on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch. Yeah.